war for the better conflict. Stephen, what's your order of things?
Please read my summary of evidence. My full name is Michael Campbell Copeland. At the request of Mr. Beresford, I've prepared evidence dated 4 April 2017 on the economic effect of the proposed rezoning of approximately 20 hectares of an area of one substitute block, with the remainder of the block retained in ecological forestry and available for continued recreational use. In the summary statement of evidence, I list the main findings of my evidence and respond to the rebuttal evidence presented by Mr. Craig Barr on behalf of the Queenstown Lakes District Council dated 5th of May 2017. The economic benefits from Mr. Beresford's submission are increased economic and social welfare, well-being for the beneficiaries, economic efficiency benefits from a more productive use of the land, the retention of the existing mountain bike facilities on the land, and the associated retention of a possible increase in expenditure by businesses to want to utilise these facilities, and an increase in the supply of residential sections, and an increase in the level of competition in the market for the supply of land for residential development in Wanaka. These particular economic benefits are consistent with the requirements of the National Policy Statement on urban development capacity. There are no economic externality costs associated with the proposed rezoning of part of the block. The proposed rezoning is consistent with enabling people and communities to provide for their social, economic and cultural well-being and for their health and safety, and having particular regards to the efficient use and development of natural and physical resources. The rebuttal evidence of Mr. Craig Barr. Mr. Barr assumes that the economic benefits of the proposed rezoning are confined to the economic benefits to the beneficial landowners of city forests. In fact, there are a number of community-wide economic benefits which Mr. Barr has overlooked. These were identified in my evidence. At paragraph 11.33 of his rebuttal evidence, Mr. Barr states that it is not the council's task to provide egress to the beneficial owners of the city forest land. However, it is my understanding that the economic and social well-being of people and communities and the efficient development and use of resources are relevant considerations for the permanent provisions included in the proposed district plan, and this will include the economic and social well-being of the beneficial landowners and the more productive use of the rezoned land. In addition, as set out in my evidence in chief, the rezoning sought will provide economic benefits to the wider Wanaka and Queenstown Lakes district communities, and therefore the relevant positive economic effects of the rezoning sought go much beyond simply providing redress to the beneficial landowners. Also in paragraph 11.33, Mr. Barr appears to suggest the proposed rezoning of some of the city forest land will see the potential loss of recreational opportunities for the wider community. However, it is from my understanding from Mr. Beresford's evidence in chief that in fact the reverse is true. The proposed rezoning will provide economic benefits to the beneficial landowners, such that they will be willing to forego returns from forestry harvesting and replant the remainder of their land holding, and a majority of the block could continue to provide recreational opportunities for local residents and visitors. Without the proposed rezoning, recreation and economic benefits from the existing mountain biking activities on the land will be lost at least for an intermittent period, if not in the longer term. See paragraphs 3.5 to 3.6 on my evidence in chief. Paragraphs 11.49 through 11.51 of Mr. Barr's rebuttal evidence are under the heading Housing Capacity and Economic Issues. As I've stated in my rebuttal evidence, Mr. Barr has not addressed the economic benefits I have set out in my evidence in chief, and this section of Mr. Barr's rebuttal evidence does not in fact address the economic issues which I consider to be relevant considerations with respect to proposed rezoning of a portion of the city branch land. Further, in this section of his rebuttal evidence, Mr. Barr relied on evidence of Mr. Osborne for counsel to conclude that there is an adequate housing capacity in the upper Glebe in the short, medium and long term. I note that Ms. Hampton's evidence on behalf of Ms. Disabilities reached her different conclusions, and she has addressed this part of Mr. Barr's rebuttal evidence in her rebuttal evidence. I note that paragraphs 11.55 and 11.56 of his rebuttal evidence, Mr. Barr concludes that there are no matters that might give rise to economic externality costs associated with proposed rezoning insofar as the provision of infrastructure is concerned.
Thank you, Mr. Patrick. To start, possibly a question. At the end of your paragraph 3.1 of your evidence in chief, you equate the market-based outcome, one that maximises economic efficiency, and so, as I read it, if the beneficiaries choose to do that, then that's the most efficient manner. If I got that right?
I've used the phrase economic efficiency there because I don't believe that environmental effects and other non-economic effects factors come into the equation of economic efficiency. Now, I realise for some economists who think economics is everything and would include those in it, the extent the word landscape effects, noise effects, or whatever, would claim those effects may suggest that the outcome is not the most economic efficient. But my interest in economic efficiency is just in regard to economic factors.
Assumes that the owners are in fact acting rationally, economically rationally.
Yes, the straight up line economics we assume that they're going to act rationally.
And I've also been reading Professor Carman's work about how irrational people in fact are in practice.
Well, economics one is how they should work, economics two is what but having rationally, what I'm saying here is that we would expect people to act in a way that is best for them from their, if you like, selfish point of view.
Yeah. Based on my knowledge of other groups of Maori owners, large groups of Maori owners, first of May, he had a formidable problem trying to convince his beneficiaries that the best option is to sell the land, even though economically that might be the economically rational thing to do.
Well, I heard your exchange with Ian Stevens this morning, and that, as I understand it, and I'm certainly not an expert here, but as I understand it, there's no cultural significance to this particular block of land. And as I answered Mr. Griffith, the last few questions, he said he sees his role to the extent that he represents the group of beneficiary landowners at the present point in time, because he'd like to maximise the net returns from this land. And that I think would line up with what I regard as a market outcome.
Yeah, I think so. blah, 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 by these trade schools.
Thank you. I'm not sure whether my question is to bring your expertise, but I want to find out.
Sure.
In coming to a conclusion about economic blend, do you have any expertise relating to returns from forestry versus returns from selling residential kitchen?
I'm a bit on a minor shareholder with a price on real estate property, the house and whack hole. They may not have no expertise. I don't really have sales as a forestry consultant, but in relation to this, I have through Mr. Crystal Camps the views of Peter Austin's representative on a number of points, and so I've referred to it there. And all I can really say is that it is my understanding that the potential net returns from forestry considered by Mr. Burson to be less than what he's proposing here. Because of the number of critical you've got about 9 million.
Okay, so I probably should have asked Mr. Burson for the next case, because I just have follow up, and that is given the constraint on free planning, which they kind of go the other, etc., whether there are any alternative species. I mean, we're just forestry survival, but I take it you can't answer that.
No, other than this office. This also contains status fir trees, which I have my understanding that they have a long time to maturity, and time is money, and that's why you find generally when someone climbs straight out as the usual plantation forest. Okay. But Mr. Burse is just, I don't know if you just want to say anything.
I can probably
connect
in my summary, but I did ask Peter Olsen this quick question. Post commercial viability, commercial viable species, there wasn't any that they could identify for this location. The two species that are up there make up 95% of New Zealand commercial forestry, and the other ones are Macrocarpa, Cypress, Euclid. I think the other main ones, Cypress would probably be the only one, but the commercial viability is pretty limited. The other two wouldn't grow.
Yes, thank you.
Should have checked with Mr. Chris before I put my money into this forest.
My name is Robert James Greenway. I am an independent consultant recreation and tourism research and planner with experience to set up my editor-in-chief of March this year. My evidence considers my references to Tiki Forest and the previous evidence as a basis for my support for the third zone proposal. Values of Tiki Forest for recreation and tourism in Waikato, the relevance of specific zone provisions to those recreation lands and zoning recommendations, and ownership and management options for recreation lands of Tiki Forest. I refer to Tiki Forest for previous evidence prepared for development for citizens today, in the first I considered the forest to be private zone, but also an important focus of national recreation rules, largely for mountain biking. We are aware, however, that the owners of the block, etc., and of the block, have the right to close all public access at any time. The ability to develop an animal and plan framework for Tiki Forest that secures public access and use is therefore quite exciting. Having been engaged in the process of identifying a development envelope of the block and reviewing the large scale of land offered for public use, I'm unnerved by the opinion that the proposal now before the panel offers significant and secure benefits for recreation and tourism in Waikato. Considering the alternatives and velocity for the public community or predominantly mountain biking and recreation. Tiki Forest is currently treated as a very important public recreation space. The users are predominantly mountain bikers that include walkers, runners and dog walkers. Trails have been built by volunteer and are to be unregulated effort. The result has been comprehensive development of the site, with a wide variety of track grades, jumps and information services, to the point where further development has been restricted by forestry management agency here policy. Mountain biking is a very important form of recreation for New Zealand, local residents, and caught the significant and growing level of interest from international visitors. I'll talk about them a bit later on as well. There's no comparable one mountain bike setting in Warrington, which is probably the most intensely developed mountain bike setting in the QDC area, and certainly the most heavily developed by volunteers, counted with the Skyline and Queenstown, of course, being the other one. The proposal will result in the majority of Peter Forest retaining the rural zone, which enables its continuing use for public recreation, currently erecting the buying of land mountain biking, and an agreement by the landowners to secure this area as public recreation place instead of shooting. The alternative is for the entire block to remain in private ownership, like fully transferred from the Crown, with the potential for it to be no longer available to public use. They result from the identification of alternative land uses under existing zoning rules by the new private or future landowners. Of the public access to the Peaky Forest would be a significant loss to recreation values in Waikato. The proposed zoning framework proposed, which proposes a number of requirements including securing the provision of public site and provision access to the rural zone area and the retention of the forestry shown in evidence of Mr. Crystal. This shows that just over 60% of the block retained outside the residential development envelope of 30.7 metres, essentially as proposed public open space. The open space area borders the full length of the reserve to the east of Peninsula Bay. The proposed residential area occupies land currently developed for mountain biking, requiring a redesign of the trail network and a reduction in the scale of existing riding opportunities. This is a trade-off to secure access and fertility over a large portion of the block. It would be appropriate to secure riding and walking access through the area marked for large block residential, most likely an easy ride to deal with the northeastern and southwestern parts of the public space, and to directly link the open space legal access roads on business and security. The proposal will allow sufficient flexibility for the residual land to be managed by public agency as public recreation land. Otherwise, the land will remain in public private ownership with a realistic prospect of no public action. The preferred options for management of public lands in a rural zone may include the management by the reserve management plan prepared under the Reserve Act, such a substance of gazettal as most likely either a recreation or local purpose reserve, with the land offering more easy options. Management plan prepared by trust or society in accordance with their deed and a constitution, or a business plan provided by a private management agency. In any case, the final zone option is unlikely to restrict any of these management or ownership options. An effective management plan based on a formal process of public consultation will assist, however, with consent applications being reserved development. I understand that managing land in commercial forests would result in about 2 years. In the future, in the removal of the exotic forest cover in 2 stages, the radiata, followed by the third. This would result in the destruction of the existing mountain bike trail, closing the block for public access for 3 to 4 years during the harvest and early retirement stages, and many years of biking in an exposed setting. Managing the forest for recreation purposes would more likely involve coupe harvesting of small areas or selective removal of individual trees as they become significantly more dangerous, which would be similar to what's happening at Victoria Park in Wellington. A non-commercial forest treatment can sustain access to social public area and facility and support the core value of recreating within forest cover. I understand there is interest from the panel in understanding the viability of operating a forest as a commercial park. In short, this is an unlikely option. Critically, the setting has quite low topography and there is no need to install a lift, which would underpin a commercial park convention. If you compare the skyline from Rotorua and Queenstown, the Christchurch Adventure Park, with the redwoods and Pokerangaway Forest in Rotorua, which has spring trees, the land has been treated, the former trade of all commercial. Otherwise, there is little to charge for and little scope to recover the cost of taking entrance fees, which is staff as well as fencing and gates needed to control entry, tractor dollars for maintenance, tree maintenance and insurance to rate, in addition to getting a decent return on the value of the property. Without a core attraction like the lift as an anchor, there is less likelihood of being able to add a cafe or other commercial service. Coffee cart and park boundary would effectively compete with any capital intensive development on the site. We would also be replacing the existing ride instead of putting volunteer effort to create the resource and would just develop or use free rides from other locations. The club could charge a nominal fee or require membership to use the park, which is not uncommon for access to some forestry blocks around the country. But such income would only serve as the activity and not make a return on the value of the land. Most international visitors to Waikato will be drawn to mountain bike trails of Great Bonnet 2, all of which are free to use, and will not form a substantial market to pay short track to grade 3 to 5, particularly with competition with the Skyline and Queenstown for the latter, which has a 400 metre climb compared with the maximum of about 60 metres to 35. In summary, I'm professionally excited by the proposal to secure Firelink City Forest as a public recreation setting, and my opinion is the proposal presents an acceptable compromise between the needs of landowners to secure long-term economic benefits from the block, while securing access to a critical component of the wider recreation scene. The proposed recreation component of City Forest Wood, in my view, retain its current zoning as rural, but with provisions to allow for the retention of forest cover by replanting in the future within the OL boundary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, a point of clarification for my benefit. Grade 1 to 5. Is 5 a cliff and 1 a flat ground, or is it reversed?
No, that's correct. 1 is a ceiling, 5 is what I believe. On City Forest, they use a colour code system, which is from green to some black. So, some black would be covered to the white stick.
Yes, so, Commissioner Tarr's code is feeling that he's having a face like that down on the post.
I lied to a lot of people who broke the collarbones and broke the wood. So.
When we went on our cyclist, the way we entered City Forest was through Northlake Park to the very top of the hill above the reservoir. Reservoir was below us on the, get my directions right, the eastern boundary of City Forest.
So that's by the smaller water tank?
We were practically next to this smaller water tank and above the castle's water supply line.
Yes.
And we walked through the forest to a clearing and we looked over the edge on the Peninsula Bayside. And like I discussed this more, it seems to me that it's highly likely to be the flat bit that he'd identified, but it seemed that it was very steep beyond that clearing. And what I'm trying to get a sense of, if you use all the flat bit, like everyone, go back to my understanding of the way City Forest works, it was like a spider's web radiating out from the flat bits when the forest down these massive drops of various steepness, depending on your enthusiasm and your skill. If you lose all the flat bits, in terms of the recreational benefit, fellas, is it realistic that you're going to have a huge value throughout once you go over the edge? If you like that, that's a very convoluted question we're trying to figure out.
I did actually go through and look at what amount of track is lost with the proposal replaced by graded track. So, maybe there's almost 25k of track in the forest. And six 0.4k is green, so that's the easier, safer area. And 36% of that would be lost to the development area. By comparison, you would lose 45% of the double black, but there's only 2k of that, and then you lose $900 million. For the blue, which is the majority of the half of all the track, you would lose 19%. But it's almost irrelevant because you can go through and put a green track on pretty much any spike. It just depends how much relief you put in. Of course, where it's available. So if you have a slope and you zigzag your track back and forward, you will maintain a green gradient, but you will lose the opportunity to bisect down there with a flat track, say, or a steeper gradient.
So you can make a really steep slope less challenging.
Yes, that's why
I'm
longer over that distance. So it's a good for a rethink of how you design the area. So at the moment you've got something that's developed, you know, quite organically. And if you were to go through and say, okay, we're not going to consume this in certain security, then you would actually go through and do a more comprehensive plan. And you would also consider, well, what are you going to do with forest in that area, and how will you manage your track? So you're going to have a good resource. But if you are going to do good harvesting, for example, which areas are you going to do first, and what are you going to recharge the list, and how will you reroute tracks through here? So it's not a matter of just going through and saying, okay, yes, we've got, here's an overlay of a residential development, and the residual is what you chuck on. So you are correct though, the green goes from currently about 6.5k to about 2.5k of free trade. But again, it's a nominal figure considering you can rebuild stuff.
But I suppose the important thing is that in your opinion, what would be left would be a valuable recreational resource for the mountain bikers.
Yeah. And also in that setting, there are plenty of grading one or two tracks around in the area. So you wouldn't necessarily go through and say that there is a defining characteristic. I mean, it's nice to ride through the trees, that's what I prefer, but it's nice to ride through the forest. So having some grade one or two through forest at a regional level is really good. But sticky forest is based on those blue and actually largely the blue and black as a slightly variety of seashells stuff for us. My son's a 40-year-old, he doesn't live. I think it's 1,000 remaining. He comes in 1,000, but it's quite a bit of fun.
Thank you. Question up. Question clear.
I think it's significant to note that part of that when we did do the site visit, the health commission, do you think the gradual bike is a possible option?
I had
Mr. Gradwell incident for a Facebook that was resulting in a deep blood lower mandible. One question. You referred to the city forest and the Lord of Rosa area. How is access to the forest managed in the Lord of Rosa if this was to go ahead, how would you envisage? I mean, obviously it's city and council is one option, but there's obvious constraints. One of the things the forest is liability, the tree will grow, the tree will fall. How is it managed in the Lord of Rosa?
I'll talk about Mount Fractus and Drunkard, because I've just done the master plan for that, and that's got Mount Fractus, and it's got a lot of old man pie in there, and it's got a restriction, I don't know if it's fascinating, but the staff, Milton Council staff, aren't allowed in there with the wind over a certain speed, because of the hazard of the tree fall, so they don't stop anybody else going in there. And I have recommended quite an aggressive agricultural approach to the forest in that, because you have suspended broken limbs and it's just looks scary. So the agriculturalism, we're quite confident that the hazard is actually quite low. Well, I have no strength because they have constantly taken both of it out. So it is a matter of just being having a good agricultural team who will manage that area. But at the moment, the pine trees, because they're not sort of like old man pine, which are shedding one of the big limbs. They are shedding limbs. So not, half a ton of wood coming down all of a sudden for no reason. It's interesting, most places like that people go into the winter is windy because it offers a shelter. So it's the fact of development. Going in there is the most dangerous to do the rain. But it's a pretended part of just managing open space. Probably would be no bike history forest areas, and certainly forest company would just close it out. If you are in Nelson, to ride through the areas managed by Pierre Volunteer and owned privately, you have to be a member of the club. So you have a tag or a dog tag on the bike to show that you're a club member and you pay your fees, and it's $70 a year. It's certainly a good value for a year. But it enables the forestry company not to necessarily know you're coming through, but to have a communication system with users. So if there is an issue, they've got everyone's email address, and they can communicate risks. So you just get a system to allow groups to know what's going on, and to manage it. There's risk. There's more risk than frankly than buying a device for example.
Totally agree, obviously, at the time later on, it's quite powerful, and since it's been, certainly it's more likely to get knocked off, clearing houses, and you want to know, so, yeah, I think they're right there, unfortunately. The core question of the lift is an anchor.
Mm.
What's the chance of getting a lift and then all in else thinking?
I don't know, but I think it would fly. It'd be, you wouldn't make any money. People would be pushing their bike up twice the time to a lift, say, like a cup of tea.
And with the advent of e-bikes,
sorry? With
the advent of the...
Oh, yes, the e-bikes, yeah.
And just interested in your statistics about international visitors to the main bikes and the big bike shoes. And I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Is that qualifying, or is that by anything, or is that just anecdotal?
Oh, it's based on my experience, really, that's been short and pain. But if you look at the market in a place like Waka, with the long, beautiful trail, and you've got the Skyline just over there, which has got a 400 metre ride, and it's got really well professionally built tracks, and you're going to try to compete with that here with mobile and you just wouldn't have the business go through and say, oh great, I'm going to invest a whole lot, I'm trying to compete with, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 grey riders in the top 10. They will be here, they're definitely going to be here, but I would not say the business plan around 30%.
You may know the business plan about attracting the year by offering them the golf tours and an array of choices.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if I would draw a circle around both golf tourism and say fire riders. No, I'd definitely draw a circle around grade 1 and 2 and golfers. I would not do it around 5. There's a certain age cutoff when you get to grade 3 and 5 where people say, you know, I don't eat all swim like this.
Doesn't matter who I think you have to have been still in the way of the eagle and the but you all get longer in the tooth than you get.
I'm 50. I've just recently decided that my two wheels will remain on the ground at all times.
Good on you for letting that public.
Well, Commissioner, speaking about that, thank you. The precise proposition that I put to Mr. Barr was whether, used clinically, the mountain biking population of Waka having 50 bars for 3 to 20 years would pay a red cent, irrespective of the level of attraction in the future, or would just both of the, I was going to say, would be thinking with actually with their bikes. And if he was inclined to share my cynicism, and so that's the proposition I've put, given that you're the expert in the field.
Well, that's why I'm not recommending money as a commercial venture. Yeah, if I was representing the beneficiaries and I was trying to come up with a concept and someone said, right, there's got a fence around it and we'll charge entrance. So good luck, you're going to make it all. But if you require people who are using it to have membership of a club and they pay a fee for that, just like, you know, we do great getting forestry jobs, there would be a willingness to pay, but it's not going to be enough to make a commercial venture. It'll be enough to help you service the setting and run the idea up there into the physical track. But you will not get a return on the value of the land by any stretch. And you certainly won't be able to charge people a lot. You have to give people a benefit in return. It's a great resource. I mean, I'm pretty sure that if you did pamphlet in the sheet, you can have to pay $100 a year to come here and use it. A lot of people would pay that. A lot of locals would pay that. But they pay it once a year. She said it's going to cost her, if she baked every weekend to come in here.
I think your response is, I'm too cynical. People would pay, but they don't pay a lot.
Yeah, well, no, people pay to belong to the club. I specifically pay my membership fee to the Nelson Mountain Bike Club to have access to the forestry area. So that's my contribution specifically for that access. I am getting something back. And there's no cash around it. There's plenty of people in there without having to pay.
As a team, access to the edges, the steeper slopes, or in your opinion, and on that flat area and access to us?
Well, I have suggested that there is an easy access through the residential area up to the top, so that's from from south to north through. And that would replicate at the moment what is actually very green tracks here, so providing more access is always you have got access, obviously, along the western side on a green route through there. On the Peninsula Bay Reserve. I don't know how you write that, but it's from the east one that goes to Kitawaka Block.
Yep.
So it doesn't actually touch the forest or the field, but it goes across the Peninsula Bay Reserve and then that just connects into the site. So you've still got all that TV access function out. I only recommend that there are a second option in addition to the existing entrance. But
it's not critical.
My feeling is that the benefit of that area is in the blue and the black. You're going there to ride downhill and have a bit of a challenge and take it to the shacks, so I'll try to get reached if I come to. And do a few jumps to get through the town. It's not to just go there and shoot them about on a nice flat track.
As you don't give up even ground just yet.
Thank you very much, Mr. Greenwood. I appreciate it. Your
Mr. Nichols?
Yes.
Operates with traffic volumes consistent with the residential environment.
access from the site will need to be via either existing or proposed local roads. I've investigated options to access these existing proposed local roads, and in my opinion, access via the North Lake site would be the most efficient. Whilst other options may be possible, further investigation will be required, and connections are across existing or proposed reserved areas. I've recommended various assessment matters associated with the future assessment of the internal road network and access provisions, including the ability of the local road network to accommodate additional traffic. In the wider area, QRDC has broad plans for improvements to the transport network identified for a business case process. I consider the comparably small addition of around 150 households to the north of Wanaka, where there is a total of about 3,000 households, will have negligible impact on the need for and timing of wider area transport network improvements. My assessment against relevant transport objectives and policies shows that the site can be developed in a way that would generally consistent with those objectives and policies. Turning to rebuttal evidence of Wendy Banks. I've read the rebuttal evidence of Wendy Banks dated 15 May 2017. In paragraph 4.5, she discusses the lack of any road provisions that would provide for connection from Sticky Forest to the North Lake Structure Plan. For clarity, my evidence in chief at paragraph 42 was highlighting that the operative North Lake Special Zoning Rule was included in council discretion as part of considering outline development plan applications, such as Rule 12.34.2.3b, 12.34.2.3k, which allow council to assess the growing has an and integration of existing development and the other sites where outline development have been approved. And it's a rule which provides for potential notification of an adjoining landowner with a consent application subject to an outline development plan where they can be affected by proposed road connection. Paragraph 4.6, Ms. Banks references an approved outline development plan for North Lake. And at paragraph 4.8, disagrees with my position that road layouts can be addressed in later planning processes. I've included a copy of the approved outline development plan in attachment A. And note that it covers about 33 hectares on the eastern part of the North Lake site and includes provisions for approximately 430 houses, or 25% of to 30% of the expected development capacity. And as the land between Sticky Forest and the approved ODP area would include approximately 66 hectares of residential development and is yet to have approved outline development plan, I consider there is still flexibility to allow for integration of the two sites from a transportation perspective. Clearly that will require some negotiation between the respective developers. So in terms of that ODP that was provided by council after my business is chief. So attachment B, the location of that ODP within the general context of North Lake. So just as there is some uncertainty in relation to the road network that may support the forest, there is also uncertainty how the future road network in North Lake will develop beyond the approved ODP area. There's a structure plan, so it's not included as one road network. So that's structure plan shows section B, which is not marked. North Lake is being developed to accommodate about 1,500 to 1,600 customers, more than 10 times as large as the proposed development. The experimental access connections at the western part of the site are not defined in the structure plan and have been met for later planning processes. A particular area of uncertainty is where the PQ Ridge will be utilised as a secondary point of access. With PQ Ridge, there would be an opportunity for a quite close link to the arterial network from the Sticky Forest area. Part of the North Lake Environmental Court Appeal, I assess use of that road with 370 households, which requires a collector road standard. That road site provides the through traffic as well as property access. Consider the additional traffic generated by up to 350 households would remain well within the traffic planning expectation for collector road formation and function.
even if Kentucky Ridge is not further developed, the approved outline development plan includes primary east-west road, North Lake Drive, which is in accordance with the structure plan road alignment and could readily be smooth further west. From the information available on the outline development plan, appears to be a medium to low road, low levels of direct property access, and includes adjoining off-road cars and pedestrian cyclists. In my experience, such a road configuration has carrying capacity typical of an important collector road. In my opinion, it is a configuration with flexibility to accommodate additional traffic from the forest. And on that basis, I disagree with Ms. Vance that there is not flexibility through future planning processes to account for connectivity between Stephen Forest and North Lake, or even other undeveloped lands such as Turumoko. My experience ongoing planning for and development of road networks between adjoining blocks of land represents good integrated land use and transport planning. I also disagree with Ms. Vance's statement that paragraph 4.9 does not consider potential additional traffic through either North Lake or the other potential routes. Or even in sheets, you have in some detail potential viability and capacity of different access routes to be a primary or secondary point of access. Recognising the current legal access constraint on further development of a road network and a structure plan at this stage, the proposed rule provisions presented by Mr. Crystal require assessment of road and walking and cycling networks. At rule 27.8(3), consideration of potential effects on the transport network is required as part of developing the road layout and access connection to be included in the structure plan. Through that assessment, the ability of roads to accommodate traffic may influence off-site mitigation required, how a walking and cycling network is developed, and potentially even the level of development serviced by each connection. In conclusion, I consider the proposed layout of lot and low density residential zoning and only part of the site can be supported from a transportation perspective. I've assessed the development and being consistent with the higher order transport planning objectives and policies. And once practical legal access options have been refined, a more detailed assessment of the local network form and impact can be undertaken and is allowed for in a rules package. I consider appropriate access options exist and wide network impacts of rezoning the site are at a low level in comparison to wide growth occurring in North Atlanta.
Thank you, Mr. President. My reading of the North Lake provisions is that they could provide a solution with the North Lake structure payment, but they're not designed for that purpose.
You said that in my reading as well.
And so, as Ms. Stephen puts me, it's all going to come together if Ms. Beresford or his successor in title can do a deal with the owners of North Lake. Any technical issues will probably fall away as part of the deal. If we can't, there will be a series of insensible problems.
In my experience, when you sit to the block of land zoned, even if it hasn't got a detailed plan, you know, at least it forces the thinking as that part of the site has been developed to consider how access has been provided. So quite often, in my experience, and I guess particularly in the Greater Christchurch area, the leaders don't very often step out from block to block. What hadn't been thought of previously does get thought of later, and previous zoning that's been done sometimes had to be modified at some point in time, or through that subdivision process they may have to go out of retention maybe they may not have had to think about at the time of the zoning.
Earlier in the series of hearings where I was sitting on the hearing on subdivision rules, there was an extensive discussion about the fact that there are examples of around
where subdivisions have been undertaken without providing for access to subdividable adjacent land and the ability of the council in practice to require that. Presumably, it's partly a matter of planning framework and partly a matter of the readiness of applicants to entertain, partly the readiness of the council to enforce it.
Yeah, it would be, it certainly comes down to some of that higher level policy even as to whether outline development plans are required to consider future connections. Some signalling of that, I think, in North Lake, but as you say, it sort of gives an indication of a set process. If this land didn't have an outline development plan, it becomes a bit more of a grey area, but I think Mr. Crystal and his evidence is the terminology, outline development plan, structure plan, things are used quite interchangeably.
And there's also a question I was discussing with this table about you must have the traffic demand of the residential areas once built. You got any comments on the issue that I was working, running logging trucks through residential areas of Wanaka?
Yeah, well, I mean, ideally, logging type traffic would access a road that's built for that purpose. A little bit like subdivision itself has a lot of earthworks, concrete trucks going in, building houses. The whole process of building a residential development does involve new vehicles in many cases. In terms of harvesting or clearing that site, allows development. The indication, or my understanding, is that it would take in a matter of up to a few months, and over that time, there's a certain number of vehicles generated. And I did some, I would call, reasonably rough calculations, but it could be if it was a fully mature forest, it would be in the order of about 700 trucks overall. For this site, my understanding is that this one is not mature at this time, and it's also a bit patchy as well, so it probably wouldn't have that sort of yield. So when you break that down over a few months, it might be in the order of 10 to 20 trucks a day. And then from that year, the council typically assessed what the potential impact of that is for a construction or basically a traffic management plan process, because this is a bit out of the ordinary, and they would put on credit limits if they felt necessary, and that might be the time of day vehicles. So given it's a shorter duration of things, I think it's something that can generally be managed, and you can obviously try and take a route to it.
Forestry trucks as well, which the chair has already asked, but just following on what has been discussed, my understanding is that forestry trucks can do quite a lot of road damage, and so I'm just wondering whether that's something that might come on in relation to the potential option, limited option, for heavy vehicles moving into that forest area.
Well, pretty much any sort of road is designed, when it's designed, it assumes it makes an assumption about how many heavy vehicles would be using it. And there would probably be, in this case, it might be a small percentage of the total of the essential heavy vehicles.
So there's a correlation then between the actual number on the road?
Yeah, and that basically leads to, can lead to degradation of that pavement life over a period, I think. the biggest impact rate on the thinner bristle pavements, so chip sealed spot pavements, unsealed roads. The construction of the subdivision road will be slightly different. I'm not a pavement engineer, so it's not something I can kind of into a lot of detail, but as I said, the total number of trucks is, you know, it's not that a significant number, you know, since within the life of the pavement that it would have been designed for. The road is kind of carrying, say, 1 to 2,000 vehicles, would typically be expected to be having at least a few percent heavy vehicles on that every day. So that builds up over time. So this is quite a small component. It would be something that would need to be considered. And sometimes as part of that process, it may be that the person doing that work had to recompensate for damage mitigation issues with the pavement that crop up. But it would require quite a detailed site investigation and as a stage those roads.
Thank you.
Just a returning to the ground, it's like one thought of one other additional question, maybe that's an issue for Mr. Crystal. Do we have any idea when North Lake subdivision is expected to reach that top corner?
Yeah, probably not really a question I can answer. From looking at the plans on the marketing material, a lot of this ODP is sold. Most of the time, so what that correlates in terms of vicious development, but I don't know.
Okay. Just want to be clear in my evidence, Mr. Chief, you referred to existing district council provisions indicating that developers are not taking council and need to give some consideration to future action. And neighbouring development sites, and that's what you're referring to in the two rules?
Yes. And I was actually referring to in my appendix as well, at page 820, paragraph 820, page 84, the established same provisions, and as the chair mentioned, there's probably some interpretation around how that would be applied.
Makes perfect sense, thank you. And with assuming that there is a path to be got through earthquake, does the building restriction area that's on the south end of the structure plan, would that be a game breaker?
Well, I think the building restriction area is for buildings. I think it talks about allowing roads. I probably have to have Ms. Crystal perhaps check that, or check that. My recent reading of that was yes, you could build a road through here, but I don't expect that subject to some assessment of site matters.
Okay. So it's got a deal breaker as such. And I understand the point about the small addition of 150 households. But there are 3,000 households in Northlake. Is this
sort of the 3,000 is really the area north of Warbury Road, including Northlake and Peninsula Bay.
The question still remains could this continue to slow and break the camel's back, or are you confident that that's covered in your assessment?
I think it covered my assessment. I did some analysis, which is referred to my evidence of what had previously been identified as one of the critical intersections, and I saw that the change in joint significant. There's a potential need for improvement at one of the intersections which was previously identified, and that would happen along. A lot sort of what would be required in any case, or it was at least identified that there would be a desirable solution, necessary being council programs as far as I'm aware of.
And one final point for application is you referred in your summary in point 10 to off road paths for pedestrians and cyclists.
Is the standard footpath considered an on-road footpath? Is it just an on-road path?
No, it's not. You would normally talk about a shared path between cyclists and pedestrians, and that is off-road. So I think that's really what I was referring to, is in that shared sense for cyclists and pedestrians.
And that would be something that would be separate from the actual footpath that they draw.
So if you look at the RDP section or summary of evidence, sort of if you come from the west side there, you can see there's that top road heading east-west. It's got the trees down the middle block, the main spine road, and that's basically in the centre of the carriageway, and that's what they started building at the eastern end. If you come a little bit further south, you can see that there's the, what looks to be a park. So that's what I was referring to, the top road.
Thank you.
One other matter, I think is much useful to know. You based your assessment on 116 lots in total. Our understanding is that residential units actually allow for main dwelling and flat, and that the a flat may be up to 150 meters.
There might be a need for individual roads to be designed slightly differently. In terms of the capacity of the network, that could change a lot, but it's not something I've analysed specifically.
Would there be enough of a difference, in your opinion, on the existing road network that this development, the zone is approved in some form, would need to
I think it, in a wider network, I would say no. The sensitivity to that would be closer to the site, and the provision that I've recommended in Russia Benefits would consider the transportation effects on those both road and the terminal itself and the road network, which would take into consideration the yield capacity. So I'm not quite sure how those rules are set up, whether it's that definition of what I didn't pick up on that.
No, well, it's something that one of the other commissioners had raised in relation to the theoretical involvement in some other things.
Yes.
I think you've got in your evidence, but can you just confirm for me the rate that you use for heavy generation per residential
line?
I think I saw it somewhere in my book of it that was interesting because it looked rather low.
In paragraph 30, I see there was 9 vehicles per day for a household.
Well, it is 9, but that's not low. No.
So, typically, as I said, that would be a suburban type household. So, if you were to develop something that's a bit smaller, then sometimes that compensates for a smaller unit generating potentially half of that amount. So, I think it's certainly not a pro rata in terms of the piece between those flats and its main models.
Okay, thank you for that.
One last question. I was looking at the Northside Street, so C1
Where does that line up with the proposed development area on Sticky Forest Road?
I haven't got a plan in front of me, but it winds up with one of the residential nodes.
So there's no issues in terms of connecting this. If there's a road into C1, provided it goes right to the boundary, it would be it will connect with the proposed development. That's my concern. Where the overlay
is. This is one of the things that are overlaid here. So, would you want to do the further that residential
part? It looks good.
Yeah. That's I had overlaid it.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
My findings for total dwellings show, based on the physical dwellings 10th of May and excluding additional capacity of 50 attached rooms in the Wanaka Townsend zone. That's for scenario one, where I exclude latent demand and I adopt the national protected infrastructure dwelling type. 65% of feasible capacity is utilised in the long term. In scenario two, where I do take some of latent demand, 78 to 86% of feasible capacity is utilised in the long term. And scenario three, where latent demand is excluded and I look more than the potential of the dwelling type, 65 to 70% of total feasible capacity is utilised. In all scenarios, the quantum of feasible dwelling capacity exceeds projected total dwelling demand. The surplus of feasible capacity ranges between 14 and 35% in the long term. I cannot determine the extent to which the model assumption of maximum development yield, if indeed this cost contradicts already known subdivision plans in some parts of Wanaka, might further erode the surplus. I reach similar conclusions of the surplus of feasible standalone dwelling capacity in the long term for Wanaka even both The surplus or buffer of capacity is a relevant issue. I have included in my graph the suggested buffer of 20% in the short to medium term and 15% in the long term identified in the NPS UDC. However, I have not appreciated that Mr. Osborne's realizable capacity was in fact the locally determined buffer that should be used instead of those suggested by the NPS. This was made clear in Mr. Osborne's summary statement of evidence. Specifically, in paragraph 22, he stated, as stated in my evidence, the district currently exhibits higher than average levels of land speculation, and although this may be a short-term issue for the market, it has played a role in the consideration of a discount rate higher than that identified in the NPS. The property economics model considers the realisation rate as a whole. As such, the 50% rate applied to the model represents the realisation rate of just over 30%, and of course, I have to 32%, when considering the whole upper cruiser market, significantly more than the 20% or 15% required by the NPS. I agree that a more conservative buffer is appropriate in this district, but have some new concerns of Mr. Osborne's approach to realizable capacity, given the comments made in his summary statement. In my supplementary statement, I express concern that a 50% development chance could be applied to 46% of feasible capacity in the Wanaka catchment, being stage 1 zones included in his model, but 100% development chance applied to 54% of catchment feasible capacity, being zones not covered by his model. On this basis, and the explanation supplied at the time, I had proposed an adjusted realizable capacity estimate where 50% was applied to all feasible capacity. Mr. Osborne now suggests in his summary statement that the 50% approach to the model zone was a practical consideration to avoid potential concerns of individual developers in special zones by suggesting significantly lower development rates on the land. Further, that the intent all along was to reach a weighted average of 68% realisable capacity, which equates to a 32% buffer on feasible capacity. I note that the weighted average is 66% inside the urban growth boundary and 76% in the rest of the catchment. The more I examine Mr. Osborne's realizable capacity figures, the less robust they become. The approach represents poor logic and would appear to fall over when applied in what should be as follows. If the intention was to achieve an overall outcome of 68%, then the 50% is completely tentative to the amount of capacity located in non-stage 1 zone. Capacity in the non-model zones being, say, 20% higher, then the development chance of model zones would need to be 46% instead of 50%. And had the non-model zones being, say, 80% of the stated figure, then the development chance of model zones would need to be 54%. However, the 68% is not informed by any stated evidence. It is a byproduct of his approach. Conversely, if the intention was to apply a 50% development chance for realizable capacity, then the overall weighted outcome is sensitive to the amount of capacity located in the non-stage 1 zone. Had the capacity in the non-model zone been 20% higher, for example, then the overall weighted outcome would be 7% instead of 68%. And had the capacity in the non-model zone been 80% of the stated figure, then it would have come out at 65%. On the one hand, this would make slightly more sense if there was evidence to support the 50% assumption, but this is not provided. If there was evidence to support the 50% development account, then it still makes no sense to exclude non-model zones from this Further, Mr. Osborne's 50 plus 100% approach will not hold up in what's different. Based on my criticism, or based on criticism containing the rules in Sheet 2, and adjusting the walk to the credit by subtracting the rate of location model credits for the walk to catchment from the same district total, this approach will mean that 80% of physical capacity in the walk to the catchment will be realizable compared to just 68% in Wanaka. This equates to a 20% buffer for walk to the the same as described in the NTU, despite Mr. Osborne's claims that a more conservative buffer is needed in the district because of the highly speculative market. Mr. Osborne has not specified that his 50% assumption applies only to the one protection. I can only conclude that he will provide a different set of assumptions and rationale for the application of the one protection model in the Walker's protection. Overall, while the council needs to adopt its cover-upper, a feasible capacity to meet the requirements of the NTU's UDC, I would recommend at this stage caution in relying on the stated realizable capacity for that purpose, as there is no evidence provided to support it. With specific regard to the submission of Mr. Beresford to create residential dwelling capacity on a portion of the city forest site, I consider the scale and the context of feasible dwelling capacity in the urban growth boundary and one attachment. It represents approximately 1.5 to 1.9% of total dwelling capacity respectively, and so any effects arising from this capacity will be small relative to the effects anticipated by the proposed project plan. The proposed capacity makes a positive, albeit small, contribution towards maintaining a buffer of growth capacity in the long term. I have considered its location relative to recent urban growth and urban infrastructure. Its location is neither isolated nor disconnected in urban form terms. Accessibility to services, including local convenience shops, recreational land, and schools, are good. The urban road access is one in which there has been a strong market preference for urban households. The lot size and dwelling size enabled by the proposed zones is in keeping with the current profile of housing supply and the localities and aligns with projected strong demand for standalone dwellings. Adjusting the urban growth boundary in this location helps delay further future encroachment of urban land use towards Glendale Bay, up the foothills of the ranges and towards the Cadrona Valley and up to and adjoining the Cadrona River. I have considered the economic and social costs and benefits of the proposed residential capacity. These are outlined in section 6 of my evidence sheet. I consider that the benefits I have identified outweigh the costs identified, but accept that this is not a complete evaluation of costs and benefits. The Beresford submission is unique in that the residential zoning seems part of a package that will deliver significant recreational benefits to the Wanaka community with lower economic benefits. When considered as a package, the net benefit is further enhanced. Overall, I consider that the proposed zoning is an efficient use of the land that supports the strategic and urban development objectives of the proposed district plan.
Thank you,
Ms.
Jackson. Am I correct in reading your evidence that to the extent there is or could be flaw in the council's DCN analysis, if in the long-term predictions beyond medium term?
So the two components, there's the demand prediction produced by Rationale, and then there's the dwelling protection model produced by the local company. So, from what I can tell, in terms of Rationale's demand predictions, that error occurs in medium to long-term range. So I would say that their predictions may be reliable for the short to medium term, but beyond that point, there seems to be something wrong. In terms of the reliability of the dwelling capacity model, as I said, I have not given it a full critique. It was not my role to review that in the evidence. I have identified a few concerns. The dwelling capacity presents a snapshot of capacity today, and that figure is used whether we're looking at short, medium, or long term. So it's not that the dwelling capacity model is not appropriate in the long term, it's whether it's appropriate, an appropriate estimate here and now.
And one of the issues that I've picked up on that you've identified is the assumptions as to what you call attached homes. You've identified
for Eve believed to be a likeness to Baal.
Like an English girl,
that there is a statistical relationship and that accords with our personal understanding of what's going on. A quick question for you is that changing? Obviously, there's a huge debate in Auckland about whether it's practical to continue to supply detached homes on a large scale and spread out across the horizon, so to speak. The unitary plan takes a view on that. Question that occurs to me is that recognising what people want or constraining what they want by what they're able to give?
Very much this is National Air that 2000 edition, so it's constrained by what the market has supplied and new people are able to purchase homes. So it is a reflection of the market. In saying that, the market doesn't take consideration of demand. So there is a meeting of the market, if you like, so there's a reflection of people's needs. Over time, you're right, in the unitary plan, they are looking at an intensive location outcome, and they're hoping, aspirationally, for a greater proportion of households to consider living in high-density homes. They acknowledge that that was going to take a generational shift of housing preferences. In order to do that, and it's driven by all sorts of things, it's got to do with affordability, etc. So you get different patterns in different parts of the country. But I think if we put the same snapshot in the future, we would see certainly emerge towards more attached housing.
More
attached.
The question that occurred to me when you were presenting your summary about the application of the principles for the gospel to the evidence to us and what's happening, and gave the difference between the world and us, but should we care? I'm in a fortunate position that that's someone else's problem. And I've got more than enough evidence to worry about relating to what happened. We try to solve the problems of what's been raised.
No, I just use that as an example. If that's his rationale, then it doesn't stack up the centre of the maximum flaws in his logic, and it's my view that by testing it against what the outcomes would be if he applied them to the Walkthrough area. What if there is a Walkthrough is going to be on Walkthrough, and I know that the model is perhaps changing as he works. But it's just an example to highlight that I think there are some concerns, and he's explained his realised book capacity now in several different ways, and I've probably got concerns with most of them.
In your original notice, looking at the percentage of occupied and unoccupied dwellings, looking at page 15, that's a snapshot that 2030 looks for tree. Up, down, or
around? I think it had been increasing, and I think it was kind of in the original evidence. I think it has grown over time. I think it's also covered in the projections of rationale attached to the evidence.
my colleague needs to divide the room, which one?
That was pretty good, thank you very much.
So, moving on to my last question for you.
Good afternoon. My name is Lindsay Hewfield. I'm senior lecturer at the Cochrane School of Business. My qualifications and experience are outlined in my introductory sheet. The statutory framework for procuring maintenance includes a consideration of the ownership of the park of landfill and through treated wetlands, which works to provide landless neighbours with the means of generating economic well-being. In my evidence, this background has been confirmed today, Section 6, A, B, and 7, C, the RMA, producing simply adverse effect on the impact value of the site. My evidence, I describe the site in summary as follows. The site is approximately 50.4% in size. The current is currently surrounded by urban boundaries of one of the townships on the east of Lake Wanaka. It's clearly visible as a patch of forestry, blankstone, and moderately elevated marine landfill. New and developing residential subdivisions surround the site. The site has been predominantly surrounded by landscape buffer strips, including building restriction areas and open space area. These reflect the Oxford rural settlement zoning of the site, the elevated aspects of the site, the value placed on the site for public recreation. It's become used as a value of recreation for many urban fabric monitor. As I understand, the site has become landlocked for most of the site itself has arranged areas of landfill variation defined by soft and hard roof line. These areas vary to 10 degrees of visibility and sensitivity to landscape change. I visited the site on 2 occasions, taking photographs from viewpoints surrounding the site. In summary, in the case from the north on the Dublin Bay Strait, which access the lake, forestry and meltwater landfall on the northern part of the site are visible. Meltwater landfall partially conceals an area within the northern channel basin on the site. From the west, the forestry on the site distinguishes it from the surrounding areas. The forestry was not present and likely that the site would appear less distinguished and more part of the continuous marine management. From the southern residential area looking towards the site, the visual prominence of the forestry on the site and the effect of accentuating its apparent height. The suburban foreground context is also apparent. From the northwest towards the site, undulating canopy landfalls gently rise towards the site where the plantation forest defines the edge of the old marine landfall. New houses and roads are being constructed in this area, creating a suburban, semi-rural character near the site. As part of my evidence, the landscape sensitivity plan, figure 13 in my graphic supplement, was prepared using computer-aided visibility analysis. This analysis defined the site being divided into 4 landscape areas based on visual sensitivity. Area A includes the northern area of Lakefront Escarpment, northern Meltwater Channel Basin, and the northern O&L part of the west facing Moraine Slope. Within this area, it was identified that there are some areas here were identified as having a low visibility from the northern lake area. Area B comprises of the western steep moraine slopes. These steep western facing slopes are visually prominent and provide landscape visibility for park glacial approaches. Area C, the upper flat part of the western slopes, are also visually sensitive, but may be able to accommodate some buildings and structures subject to careful building and landscape design controls. Area D, through the analysis process, this area was identified as most suitable for visually absorbing residential development, subject to careful building location and design controls along O&L edges and ridge lines to ensure that potential adverse effects are adequately mitigated. As part of this analysis process, the boundary line of the proposed O&L and the proposed district plan was also reviewed. My conclusion was that the boundary line of the O&L should be refined to align more accurately with the ridge line as part of preparing a future structure plan for the site using more detailed contours. just to add a notion there, this exercise is partly undertaken as part of the 13 also. I consider that the location of the L&L on the western side of the site is located too far south in the proposed district plan. It could be moved northwards to align with the more prominent moraine landforms that face the lakes, which are more strongly expressive of the geomorphological usability and aesthetic consideration of the L&L plus area and the remainder of the western slopes, than the remainder of the western slopes of the site. The landscape sensitivity plan also identified that residential developments along the ridges should be avoided and that the main north south ridge line and L&L boundary should be given buffer landscape treatment for specific design controls. The revised submission extends beyond the areas identified in the landscape sensitivity analysis as potentially being able to accommodate low density and large block residential developments, and speaks developments within the areas identified in the proposed district plan of O&L. In principle, I consider the residential development in the O&L area identified in the landscape sensitivity as this landscape extension. Due to this part of the site being within an area of visual catchment from the lake, the building is currently not visible on the upper and mid slopes of the moraine gardens. However, I acknowledge in my evidence that the landscape visibility analysis identified that parts of the L&L area have low ground level visibility from the lake, and that existing forestry reduces the natural character of the L&L area. The forestry was retained to some extent, it could potentially enable buildings or structures to be visually absorbed and screened within the L&L from views on the lake. In my opinion, if residential development in the L&L was to occur, it should be very carefully mitigated through design controls. I'd also add that, in fact, the boundary is approximately 50 metres from the shoreline of the lake, so there is a number that's still quite a bit there to the L&L boundary. The proposed controls in the revised submission for the large lots residential areas will be subject to negative discretion and rules. In principle, I consider these proposed controls strict with mitigating potential adverse landscape effects with proposed large lot residential development within the O&L. As part of the proposed controls, I recommend that the requirement for a landscape plan be included in for each lot and building platform area, access way landscape treatments and coordination with an overall master plan landscape planting strategy, and that the landscape plan should address the following matter. Proposed plantings mitigate potential long-term visual effects and resist the integration of buildings into the landscape system. Retention of existing vegetation to mitigate short, medium and long-term potential landscape effects. Screening of genetic activities and within identified privileged areas around buildings, visual integration of buildings within integrated landscape settings, fencing designed to minimise adverse visual effects, minimisation of earthworks and mitigation of potential visual effects of cut surfaces or retained land, lighting designed to avoid glare, light spill and visibility of foliage and building. On further reflection, after having prepared my evidence, I consider that residential development is to occur in the L&L. It should be treated as a comprehensively designed part of the site. The design of the landscape and building architecture should have a site-specific coherent character that is complementary to the natural value of the lake foreshore and the landform setting. An additional method to assist with achieving this would include requiring a specific development concept plan for development in the O&L with supporting architectural landscape design controls and design. I also consider that architectural design should be included at the time of lodging to prevent applications subject to matters of discretion such as the design and appearance of buildings to achieve a considerable form and character that is complementary to the natural setting. Building elements to be assessed include the orientation of buildings following natural contours, potential clustering of dwellings and building elements, articulation and modulation of building form, height and mass to reduce the potential visual bulk of buildings, and to provide for integrated landscape treatment around and amongst building modules. Coordination with the landscape plan, roof pictures that reflect landforms and slopes, lighting design to reduce glare and eave design to reduce reflectance with glass, windows and doors. Consistent use of separate external building biosphere from the external building materials recovered from surface sweep activity, visual screening of building privilege and sourcing areas to be from the use on the way. In terms of the structure plan, also as part of my evidence, I outlined landscape new design principles that I consider should be part of the future preparation of the structure plan for the entire site. These are preparation of the concept master plan. The O&L boundary line should be finalised through further investigations using detailed topographical survey information. Appropriate landscape buffer areas and design controls along ridge lines and edges of the O&L should be established. Further investigation of potential for identified building platforms and privilege areas on the southwestern upper slopes of the site. Identification of areas for development densities within the proposed low density residential area, including opportunities for clustered development. Development of building and landscape design controls, provision for eligible network and hierarchy of public access, integration of cycle networks, consideration of urban design and landscape treatment of the eastern boundary with the North Lake structure plan area, identification of a or preparation of a landscape management plan area outside of the residential area. I would also now add the further provisions recommended for residential development in the O&L area. So to conclude, in my opinion, the site is capable of absorbing low density residential and some large lot residential development subject to design controls. Density designed residential development on the site could potentially contribute to the economic well-being of the collective owners while protecting outstanding natural landscape and maintaining the quality of landscape and energy values by the site. The revised submission proposal includes large lot residential development in part of the identified O&L area. In my opinion, if this area is to include residential development, it should be comprehensively designed with landscape and architectural elements having very low visual impacts and a strong sense of spatial and character integration and connected freedom. I consider the potential benefits of the submission include the development of a high quality residential housing, with design controls and landscape setting and enhanced indigenous landscape character of the site with continued recreation and formalised and managed way.
I'm going to go to your page, your page 13, please. And I want to focus on the extent to which the suggested large lot residential area improves into area B, which you said should be retained free of built structures. And at that point when there is only my little mind, it does not compute. So I'll ask Mr. Crystal that, but I'll start with you. Can you explain, do you support pushing the line of the pushing down to the large block residential to the white line? And if so, can you explain the mismatch?
The area C, as was identified as a sort of a tiny yellow tiny, that's an area I identified through visibility analysis as potentially being able to accommodate structures, visually accommodate structures. The area where the white line extends beyond that area, I wouldn't support structures in that area, but there is a potential for the lot. The house sites might be in the orange area, but the lots may extend over beyond that area towards the white dotted line. So I hope that explains how that could work. I think because there is the restricted discretionary status and the amounts of discretion, some of those the sort of practicalities of the visual effects and so forth could be worked through in more detail once building platforms and so forth are identified. So that's how that might work.
Does that mean that you would support a building restriction area in the balance of area B beyond the
I'll call it the yellow book, close enough.
Yeah, I would, based on the work that I've done to date. Just a quick improvement made through the process of going for further consents, and discretionary consents, that there wouldn't be any significant adverse effect visually beyond the area I've identified. I'd still be open to considering that, I think.
Next thing is that the suspicion has been made to us by others that visibility is not a continuous of adverse effects on an O&L because of the range of qualities of O&Ls. And I'd invite your comments on that proposition.
I would agree with that proposition. I think, that works through the petition day criteria and so forth. You know, obviously not just about aesthetics and visual impact. But I think in this instance, my reading of the O&L values are to do with, there's certainly the extending of the lake and so forth, and the natural values of the lake, the natural science values, but also to do with the geomorphological, or strictness with the geomorphological visibility. And that's why I say my evidence in principle. Where I have looked at the O&L line is largely determined by how specific it is of the meltwater channel in combination with the visibility from the lake. So those two things are sort of the criteria in my mind as to where the line should be. And they say one informing the other is here, so they're not acceptable.
Well, the good thing is that there's no sort of breeze that you all shift to that line, so that's one reason. Problem, I swear, that only about 500 to go. So Campbell, I'm putting it in the
field. My question is, why should it say has put to you, but I'm actually not clear that the relationship is between the O&L line that you are using and the relationship to the O&L line. And I'm just wondering if you can take me through that. Should I be able to see from one of the photomontages the view of the O&L area that you're talking about in
yes,
the North Lake Bend?
Photograph number one.
What's 2.1?
2.1, yes, that's right. So that photograph was taken on the Double Bay track looking towards the site on the left-hand side, you've got the North Lake boundary, and essentially, and then on the right, you've got the Peninsula Bay boundary. So the site of the extent of the site is estimated with the dotted line at the top. So what you can see is the forestry. You can see the landform variation in terms of the melt channel coming down through the site. The area where that is being talked about in terms of the large block residential being located in the O&L is, if you like, labeled that extent of the site at the top, sort of within the melt channel. It's difficult to see exactly how that works because you've got the height of trees and so forth in the photograph. So the actual ground level is below the surface that you're seeing with the canopy of trees. But you see, with the matter of discretion, working through a comprehensive design for that area in terms of building platforms, house design, and location and so forth, you would go through a more rigorous vision assessment in terms of, you might even model sort of, built form in there to see how visible that we're creating, and how much of the existing forest you might keep, and how much new funding you might put in most of
it. So just in relation to North Lakes and the development that will occur there, is there a linear relationship between that Mount Channel and subdivision within North Lakes? Yes.
Not really, it's the sort of attachment of the phone that's really within the site. There are similar sorts of channels, but they offer the aspects differently. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that sort of energy moraine there.
Thank you,
that's helpful. Yeah. Thank you. Just while we've got that photo up for both of us, can we just put what the profile of the Leopard Mountain Group? Does it follow the tree line? Like I noticed that the tree line goes up the hill to the right hand side of the photo.
I think it does. I think that would be it. The graphic supplements shows the boundary.
Yeah.
Figure one shows the approximate line.
In the previous page, it was a good problem. And in terms of area C1 that we talked about on the North Lake plan, is that the other part of the city forest boundary, the production area?
That's right, yes.
Is that basically over the top of our site?
Yes, that is. I had an image of the action, which was a plan that was approved by the environment court hearings with the North Lake that shows the structure plan over the top of the area of the photograph, which I can bring up and show you in that image. But
I wonder if you could email it to our hearing administrator and we'll take us to the clip, because that would be helpful. I don't think I'll split your trust in the machine. If I could leave that with you, please, to forward on. And what are we up to in the
city? That will be 35.
Thank you.
The difficulty is that the LIDAR was flying with forestry in place, and so there's some circulation that's done through forestry. And then, in order to build the terrain models and so forth for visibility analysis, there's some further circulation that gets done.
So, as I understand it, accepting your qualification that this is not your experience season, so taking an approximation, but between a quarter and half a metre of the land with a more further margin of error because of the forest, or is that included?
That's included. I mean, it is really outside my area of expertise, but the LIDAR that's used is well accepted as being a good indication of the landfall. but it won't be grazed away hectares, the thing that you would get from the other.
Taken up and attended to it, since we know for an hour and 2 minutes. For 2 hours. We'll
we'll be back at 3:25.